You're listening to a programme from BBC Radio 4.
Order, order.
Good evening, this is Mark Darcy at Westminster. Tonight, bargain basement prices for grand designers who want to build their own homes.
The £7,500, when you realise you can buy the kit to build your home for that, actually it brings it into an affordability level that many people don't realise is there.
And plans to lobby Parliament to ensure there's an inquiry into child abuse.
Are we going to see stones that need to be lifted up, looked under?
But first tonight, MPs have been told that more than 100 European doctors have been refused a licence to practice medicine in Britain due to their poor English skills. The Health Minister and Dr Dan Poulter said 128 doctors from the European Economic Area had failed to meet the necessary criteria since new regulations were brought in last April. The General Medical Council extended its checks following the death in 2008 of David Gray. He died after being treated by a locum doctor from Germany on his first shift in the UK. The revelation came during a debate on a bill from the Conservative backbencher Jeremy Lefroy, aimed at improving patient safety in the wake of the scandal at the Mid-Staffordshire NHS Foundation Trust, and to make sure information's always shared between various bodies involved in someone's care.
It will ensure that every Secretary of State will make patient safety a priority at all times. Would that have prevented the tragic events at Mid-Staffordshire or in other hospitals, surgeries or care homes? Certainly not in every case. But I'm convinced that the attention given to safety would have done precisely that, prevented much avoidable harm to patients.
The veteran Conservative Sir Bill Cash put forward an amendment calling for the General Medical Council to be given more powers to ensure that doctors practising in the UK had appropriate language and communication skills.
In April last year, the Medical Act was amended to strengthen the arrangements to ensure that all doctors have sufficient knowledge of English before being able to work in the UK. And this proposed amendment would help to ensure that all doctors are able to communicate effectively with colleagues and patients, which will significantly reduce the risk to patient safety caused by a lack of understanding of the English language, resulting in the misdiagnosis and treatment of conditions. So I think that many people would regard this as a very important but also a very common sense provision.
He was supported by his Conservative colleague Jacob Rees-Mogg.
The lack of good language skills, of understanding the language, is a danger in both directions. It is a danger for the doctor who is listening to the patient explain his or her symptoms, but it's also a danger when the doctor explains to the patient what steps the patient needs to take for better health.
But the Shadow Health Minister, Jamie Reid, didn't think Sir Bill's amendment was needed.
The General Medical Council conducts English language assessments already, and failure to undertake an assessment or failing such an assessment can result in fitness to practice hearings, which can result in a loss of registration to practice. These assessments can be triggered in a number of ways. A single complaint from a patient, complaint from a health professional or another party can result in an assessment as well as prescribing errors and poor record keeping.
And the Health Minister, Daniel Poulter, said the changes which came into force in April had had an impact.
128 European area doctors have been refused the licence to practice medicine in the UK due to inadequate language skills, which shows this is a measure that's working to protect patients in the UK from doctors from within the European Union who can't speak English effectively.
He added that the Nursing and Midwifery Council was looking at revalidating nurses in a similar way. Sir Bill Cash later withdrew his amendment, and the bill will now go off to be considered in the Lords. Then MPs turned to a bill designed to encourage more people to build their own home to their own design. The Conservative Richard Bacon's Self-Build and Custom House Building Bill would require local councils to keep a register of land available for self-build housing and to take self-build into account in their planning policies. Mr Bacon said it would bring much-needed choice about house design into the market.
The aim of the bill is to start to unblock the logjam of housing supply by allowing customers more say over what they actually want, rather than leaving them very little choice but to accept what a big developer tells them they want.
It was much more common in countries like Germany and the Netherlands for groups to get together and self-build not just single homes but whole communities.
We should have no doubt that involving local people much more closely in developing the housing which they want to see is an approach which has enormous power to help transform communities.
For Labour, Lynn Brown welcomed the bill.
Whilst this bill stops short of proposing the fundamental change needed, and as set out by Labour to tackle the housing crisis, it proposes concrete steps that will help to boost the self-build and custom house-building sector.
There was cross-party support for the bill, with MPs spotting all kinds of advantages. Another Conservative, Andrew Bingham, said self-builders were usually far more keen on energy efficiency.
If there is an energy-saving device that will drastically reduce your energy costs, whether it be solar panels, whether it be heat source pumps, whatever it might be, and some technologies that are in their infancy, it is something you are going to look at. And when you put that in that house, it is there forever. So as well as driving up the overall quality of the houses that we're building, I think self-builds can also help along the environmental agenda as well.
The Housing and Planning Minister, Brandon Lewis, said self-build should not be seen as an option just for the very rich. It could be the cheapest way for people to get the home they wanted.
We all enjoy watching great programmes like Grand Designs, but one of the things people don't realise is that you can do custom build and self-build at an affordable price, that you do not necessarily need to have a lot of money to build a home. And I'll note them again, so as I say, for £7,500, when you realise you can buy the kit to build your home for that, actually it brings it into an affordability level that many people don't realise is there.
And he said the bill would also provide a stepping stone towards the government's proposed right to build,
which would give prospective custom builders the right of a plot of land from their local council for the first time. The consultation set forward our vision for the right, that eligible prospective custom builders will be entitled to register with their local planning authority for a suitable service plot of land on which to build or commission their own home.
Mr Bacon's bill was passed without a vote. It now goes forward to the House of Lords. There was less success for another Conservative MP who put forward a bill to give the UK absolute control over who comes into the country from abroad. Christopher Chope wants Parliament to decide which non-UK citizens can enter and say under what circumstances they can be told to leave. He began his speech with what he said was a chilling thought.
The United States had both the suspects of the recent Paris atrocity on Wednesday on their travel ban list. But the two French citizens who are the suspects were freely able to come and go from the United Kingdom, should they have so wished. And that, Madam Deputy Speaker, is one of the consequences of our current lack of control over our own borders.
He said there'd been a million net increase in migration over this Parliament, and the government estimated there were, at any one time, around 500,000 people here illegally. His bill would provide a fresh starting point.
Everybody would have the opportunity of, who's not here legally, they would have the opportunity of either leaving, seeking to regularise their position by applying for a certificate, or facing the consequences of failing to do.
But the Minister, Karen Bradley, argued the bill wasn't necessary, as the government had just introduced a new Immigration Act only last year.
For example, we have revoked more than 4,500 driving licences held by illegal migrants and deported more than 150 criminals since July 2014 using new powers provided by the Act.
It was now easier to remove those with no right to be in the UK, she said. There'd been a crackdown on sham marriages and people would no longer be able to hide behind what she called weak human rights claims. And having raised the issue, Mr Chope then withdrew his bill. Now, next week, the bill to allow terminally ill people to take the option of assisted dying is back before the House of Lords. When it was first debated back in July, it produced a moving, highly emotional 10-hour debate. And since then, peers have moved on to the detail of how such a system might work. Already, they've rewritten part of the bill to ensure a High Court judge has to give permission for a person to seek assisted death. And next Friday, there'll be more detailed debate on the safeguards the process will need. But the parliamentary clock's ticking, and this bill is some way from clearing the House of Lords, and there certainly won't be time to get it through the Commons before the general election. So what's the point of continuing? A question I put to the former Lord Chancellor, Lord Faulkner.
We are closer to there being a change in the law if there's been detailed scrutiny of a bill in one or other House of Parliament. So the more it's scrutinised, the closer, I believe, that we are, whether it's because somebody will pick up a bill like this, either in the Commons and the Lords, after the general election, or because there's more public debate about it. Either way, we're closer to a new bill. Maybe it could be carried over.
One of the things that has changed in the process of this scrutiny is you've got a whole new mechanism for someone who wants to consider assisted dying because they're terminally ill. Would now, under changes that you've accepted, there be a process in the High Court?
Correct. In the first day of the committee stage, the Lords agreed that a High Court judge would have to consider whether or not the individual who was considering whether or not to have an assisted death had a firm and settled intention to end their own life, whether or not that conclusion was voluntary. So there would be the safeguard of a High Court judge reaching a conclusion in relation to that. Prior to the change, the safeguard was two doctors, independent of each other, considering whether or not the safeguards had been met. Now you have a situation where there are two safeguards and a High Court judge after a hearing.
Now, there have been quite a number of bills on this theme over the last few years. Your colleague Lord Joffe put in a number of them, and they didn't seem to get anywhere. This bill has gone further. Why do you think that is?
Because the public are much more interested in this issue now than they have been previously. People are much, much keener to have much more control over their final illness and how they die. And that's reflected in the numbers of people who go to the Dignitas Clinic in Switzerland, in the attitude of both the courts and those in charge with the enforcement of the criminal law, in particular the Director of Public Prosecutions, who've had to change their positions because the public are moving in relation to their attitude to how they die.
But there still remain people who have deep moral objections to the whole idea of assisted dying. The Church of England called on you to pull the bill and have a royal commission on the subject instead. Is it the case that they've just, realising that this bill is not going to get through, haven't really therefore engaged with it, and the objectors are still out there and still unconvinced and still ready to try and block any serious attempt to get this on the statute block?
I don't really know about the position of the Church of England, because they tell me that it's not moral objections, it's they don't think the safeguards are strong enough. I don't know whether their position has now changed in the light of the change that's been introduced in the Lords, because the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Archbishop Carey, is now in favour of a change in the law. Archbishop Tutu, who's part of the Anglican Communion, is also in favour of a change in the law. So I don't think the Anglican Church any longer represents a monolithic bloc against it. So I think even they are changing their view in relation to this.
How long do you think it's going to be before this gets on the statute book, or are you still uncertain it'll make it?
I think it will be sooner rather than later. I think a big question now is, will the political parties in their manifestos for this forthcoming general election commit themselves not to being yay or nay on the bill, but to Parliament at least having time to make up its mind? Whatever view you take in relation to this, the public are now of the view that Parliament should at least make its mind up on this. What is Parliament for if it is not to make decisions about whether the law on an issue like this should be changed?
Lord Falconer on his assisted dying bill. Next Wednesday, there'll be a lobby of Parliament to call for a statutory inquiry to cover organised and institutional child abuse since 1945. One of the organisers, the Labour MP John Mann, explained the concerns behind it.
Well, this thing is dragging on, and the question being asked is it going anywhere? Are we going to see stones that need to be lifted up, looked under, and whatever's under there found out and investigated and something done about it? You know, we have these various VIP and Westminster and other prominent people allegations. We have police investigations in London and all over the country. We have more and more people coming forward and making very tangible allegations. And we're seeing slow progress. I think that people want to see quicker progress. They want to see systems in place that hold the establishment to account and give proper support to those who've survived these horrendous events in their childhood.
How do you think this situation of a sort of stalled inquiry is being viewed in government now, and the building pressure for something to happen?
There's certainly a lot of nervousness in government. The penny has dropped with some how big an issue this is, and how if they get it wrong, that's going to be careers over for some ministers. Therefore, they have to get the call right now, and it hasn't been got right.
Well, one of the big stumbling blocks in setting up an inquiry has been finding someone suitable to chair it. So far, two candidates have been put forward and have then backed out. So to find out more about the business of running a high-profile inquiry, I turn to Lord Laming, the convener of the Crossbench Peers. He chaired the inquiry into the murdered child Victoria Clombier and one of the inquiries into the murders by the serial killer GP Harold Shipman.
The key issue about any inquiry is what is the inquiry for, what are the things that will be in the inquiry, and what are the things that will be out of the inquiry, being clear about the terms of reference. On the basis that these matters are of such concern that people will bring hopes and aspirations for the inquiries that perhaps are unrealistic, people will bring different agendas, so the terms of reference are absolutely essential. Hours spent on precision about the terms of reference save weeks and possibly months later in dealing with threats of legal action or indeed legal action taking place.
Now, normally those ground rules, if you like, are handed down by a cabinet minister. You know, the Home Secretary, if it's something to do with public order, the Transport Secretary, if it was, say, a transport disaster or something of that kind. Who should be writing those ground rules? Should it be that cabinet minister?
My view is that these matters are so important that they need to have the approval of Parliament. They need to have the authority of Parliament.
So you'd like to see, what, some kind of parliamentary vote or...?
No, I think that it's very important that the Secretary of State or Secretaries of State, and it may be more than one, should come to Parliament and should set out to Parliament the terms of reference of the inquiry and then who would chair the inquiry. But you've probably realised already I attach much more importance to clarity about the terms of reference than almost anything else. Also, Parliament should know what powers are invested in the inquiry. That is, the powers to secure all the documentation, the power to require witnesses to come and give evidence, and the power also to make sure that the inquiry is conducted in a way which is fair to everybody, and in particular, is fair to the people who will be coming to the inquiry with a great and understandable sense of grievance.
One of the key things, I suppose, is that people who come to the inquiries must feel they've had their day in court. What are the ways in which that can be achieved?
When I did the Victoria Clombier inquiry, I lived what I would call a monk-like existence. I went to enormous lengths never to be seen in the company of anyone who had anything to do with the inquiry outside the hours of the inquiry, even to the point if I saw witnesses on the same tube train that were coming to give evidence to the inquiry that day, I would miss that tube or go further down the line. I think that it is absolutely essential that in an inquiry, the person who chairs the inquiry should command the confidence of all and should have exactly the same relationship with all and can never be accused of partial interest.
I suppose the other key thing that the person chairing an inquiry has to have is a pretty fireproof quality. Some inquiries will have an awful lot of political heat bubbling under them. There may be enormous campaigns in the press. There can be all sorts of factors that put enormous pressure on the person in the chair.
There will be an enormous range of emotions and interests expressed. And these need to be taken seriously. They are important. And part of the value of a public inquiry is it gives the opportunity for people to know that their concerns have been taken seriously. They've had the opportunity to give evidence to an independent and impartial body, and that they can be satisfied that there will be a degree of objectivity about producing the conclusions and the recommendations. My own view is, unless the inquiry secures that kind of involvement, that kind of confidence, then it will not reach conclusions that people will say, well, they're fair conclusions, they're right conclusions. It's enabling people who've been affected by these matters to be able to tell the story, because it's in telling their story that the inquiry can get the full picture and can reach the right conclusions.
Lord Laming. Finally, these days, there's an app for everything, from ordering fast food to telling you if your train's on time. And now the Conservative MP Jake Berry's come forward with a novel way for smartphone users in his constituency to get in touch.
So, Mark, I'm opening the app up here, which is available on any smartphone. Start off with what we call the landing page, which says Jake Berry MP, tell Jake. You click report the issue. You then have a drop-down menu. So you can report everything from potholes to a block drain to traffic lights being out, street cleansing, graffiti, car parking, abandoned vehicles. You choose whatever your problem is. I'm choosing.
In his Westminster office, Jake Berry shows off the latest must-have accessory for the active constituency MP, a smartphone app.
Now, one of the big problems I have when constituents want to report issues to me is always quite hard to locate where exactly where they are. So this app enables me to click the Locate Me button, which will find you anywhere in the country as long as it's available on Google Maps and it's showing our location as here where we're recording. That has recorded our location. And then you can give it a title. So I'm going to call this Parking Issue. And then there's a box where you can give any more detail about it. As much detail as possible is really, really helpful, because it enables the local authority and me to carry out a full search to find the issue. And you also have the option of uploading a photograph, so we're going to do that now to show a picture of this problem parking we've got between us. I'll take the photograph here and now on my phone, which you can see this vehicle parked here. We'll take a picture of that. And then you just put your email and your mobile number and click report it now. And that sends an email to me and also to Street Repairs UK, the website I've teamed up with to do this app. And we, together, will report it to the relevant authority.
There's a bit of a backstory.
I achieved a bit of local fame by offering to go and race one of the county councillors down the worst street, as I called it, in the UK, on a bicycle, and almost offered him a drink if he could get to the bottom of the street without falling over, because it was so bad. So because of that, we launched what we call the Pothole Patrol campaign, and that was just about finding an easy way that people can report issues to me as their MP, who could then pass it on to the council. Because of the success of that campaign, we reported over 1,000 potholes in a 12-month period. We were contacted by Street Repairs UK, which is a not-for-profit business, which is really trying to make it as easy as possible for people all over Britain to report potholes, about developing an app together, a Tell Jake app for use of people in Rossendale and Darwin to report potholes and other issues on their street, and working with them to get the council to report it. People often say that they see an issue, they mean to tell me about it, it's too complicated. This means that everyone who has a smartphone in their pocket can download this app, take a picture of it, record it, register it, and I'll keep in touch with them, telling them how we're going, getting the problem repaired.
But is this a case of MPs becoming super councillors, spending time on ultra-local issues, when their job's supposed to be about scrutinising new laws and cross-examining ministers? It's an argument Jake Berry rejects.
I think MPs do both. I have never had anyone say to me up in Rossendale and Darwin that they are upset because I'm too interested about the issues that matter to them day to day. I think that I live there, I live locally in my area, and I want the area I live in to be as good as it can possibly be. So I'm not going to go out with a bag of asphalt and fill that pothole. I'm not going to go out with a gritting bin and grit your street. But what I can help you do is work with the councillors, with the council, with the higher tier authorities like a county council, to make sure that that actually gets done for you. That's the power of being the MP.
There's an old political proverb that all politics is local. It's truer now than ever, he says.
In 2010, we got a whole tranche of new MPs in who have less allegiance to the party and more allegiance to the place they live. They're hardworking, they get out and about, they roll their sleeves up, they get stuck in. And I think that's the way it should be.
Jake Berry, and that's it for now. I'm Mark Darcy. The editor was Alicia McCarthy, and that was Today in Parliament.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.